girls. What? Keep it fresh.
Hi, welcome to Female Trouble. I'm Quinn Kelly, and this is a podcast spotlighting women in Baltimore. Tracy Diamond writes about identity, chronic pain, and the female body. Tracy's latest work is a chapbook called To Tracy Like, To Like, Like, a long-form poem about sexism, vulnerability, and health, which she reads from in this episode. Tracy also co-curates Ink Press Productions, which specializes in handmade books, letterpress printing, and experimental events. We talked about the suburbs, the sad woman writer, and how Tracy's background as an athlete informs her work. Here's our conversation. So tell me a little bit about yourself.
Well, I am a poet, and I like to also just call myself a writer because I do write in other genres, living in Baltimore, Maryland currently. I've been here about 8 years, and I am just very interested in how poetry and writing can sort of be catalysts for all sorts of creativity.
Do you remember the first poem that you wrote?
I do, and I'm very lucky that my parents saved a lot of my writing from childhood. So one of the first poems I wrote was about fireflies. And one of the stanzas, it ends with like, oh, firefly, how you must dine. It's just very silly. And I still see fireflies cropping up in my work. Not so much in this long poem, but I guess I'm just attracted to their light.
Do you remember always noticing small things like that? Have you always had an attention to detail and minutiae?
I think so. It's just pretty ingrained, so I don't necessarily notice it. But I find when I'm writing, I'm pulling from all sorts of things I overhear or see. So a lot of what I write includes brief descriptions or snippets from like the Today Show or NPR, because I'll hear some turn of phrase and think, oh, that's interesting, or that's an unusual way to look at something. I need to write about this.
Do you think you're an observer?
Yeah, I spend a lot of time watching and reading.
Have you always been a big reader?
Yeah, I've been a big reader. It started about the same time as a big writer. So one of my first big influences is the book Go, Dog, Go. Because if you've read it, the syntax in that is so weird, where the two dogs constantly meet each other and the conversation just goes, do you like my hat? No. Okay. Goodbye. Or something like that, where it has the repetition in that book has always grabbed me. So I think that's also why I gravitate towards poetry.
The repetition?
Yeah.
Yeah, I have noticed that in a lot of your work. I mean, for people who have not encountered your work, I'm sure it's not like fun to describe it for people, you know, like no artist or writer or musician I've talked to really loves like describing their own work. They'd rather have you listen or read it. But how would you kind of sum up some of the topics that interest you and some of your style?
Sure. So ever since I've been more seriously writing, and I got my MFA, which is a master's in fine arts in creative writing and publishing arts at the University of Baltimore, I've been very interested in identity and how we write about ourselves and perceive the selves. And that probably goes back to what I studied in undergrad, because I studied communication theory and history. So we would talk a lot about impression management and how you see yourself affects how other people see you and how you internalize how they're seeing you. So there's a lot of that feedback loop in my work. And then it's very driven by obsessions with neon and death a little bit.
What brought you to Baltimore?
I graduated from undergrad in 2010. And so that was a tough time in the economy. So my only goal at that point in life with getting a job was to just have a job in a city and really go out there and experience what's happening in the world rather than going back to my parents in Pennsylvania. So I didn't stray far, but I ended up at a law office in Baltimore. And then not too long after I moved here, I started going to poetry readings and found that people were in town creating, and I realized I wanted to stay.
Did you know about that scene before you came to Baltimore, or what was your impression of the city, if any, before you lived here?
I didn't have a lot of thoughts on Baltimore before I moved here. The last time I had been here prior to being an adult was when I was 10, going to the National Aquarium and seeing a dolphin show.
Classic.
Yeah, I was a swimmer and we did all sorts of water-related activities. So moving here, my impression was just that it's a city with a lot of potential and a lot of struggle. So when you come here, you have to be really open to listening to other people and learning from other people and not trying to claim something over them.
Where did you grow up?
Pretty equally in New Jersey and Pennsylvania. So northern New Jersey, very different from eastern Pennsylvania, even though they're close. Northern New Jersey was just a whole bunch of different cultures that I experienced at a young age. And then we moved to Pennsylvania, and it's much more homogeneous. Having those two different experiences as a kid, I knew I wanted to end up somewhere where I was around all sorts of people.
Was it like were you in the suburbs, or what kind of places did you grow up?
Right. So it was I like to call Union a town because everything's very walkable. We were like a couple minutes walk from the town center where there was a movie theater, restaurants, an ice cream shop called Magic Fountain, which is still there. So it's been there for at least 30 years. And then moving to Pennsylvania, it was in a part of the state where it's very suburban sprawl, where right around when my family moved there, a lot of the developments were popping up and all the cornfields that were there before were gone. So it's Union always felt like it had, everything was very established. And there are already lots of people there. And then when you move to the suburbs, there's really no identity, which might also be why I'm so obsessed with identity in my work.
I feel like a lot of times, like, the suburbs are, I mean, maybe this is totally me projecting, but the suburbs are this thing that a lot of creative people want to escape. But then there's also this kind of nostalgia that can wash over a lot of work, or I think of even like The Virgin Suicides or something, and this like dreamy depiction of the suburbs. And I'm curious, in your work and thinking about identity, how does your upbringing kind of play into that? Is it a positive association? Tell me more about that.
It's ambivalent because there were some wonderful things growing up there. I went to a great public school. So I was exposed to a lot of writing then. But for me with the suburbs, it's a lot of facade. So that's where the impression management comes in, where you're seeing one thing and then something else is going on. Like in The Virgin Suicides, they seem like a perfect family. They're all beautiful young girls. And then they're all committing suicide that summer. Yeah.
Or so like The Stepford Wives, or any kind of like, yeah, classic suburban piece that comes to mind. There's always that dark underbelly.
Yeah, there's the dark underbelly. And something I am trying to articulate in my work, and so I'm still exploring it and not sure how to write about it, which for me is the poetry and writing is always trying to figure out how to articulate something. There's a discontent in a lot of writing about the suburbs that no one seems to be able to like pinpoint where the discontent is coming from. And it's sort of like a genre of writing where it's like the sad white woman. and I don't want to be in that genre of writing, so I'm thinking about it as I'm writing. But I have yet to pinpoint why, other than the emphasis on being a certain way, like why the suburbs are such a thing, are something that people write about that they have this discontent with.
It's kind of like the criticism in literature too about women writing the domestic and men writing the universal. It kind of reminds me of that. You write a lot about, I won't say feminism, but you write a lot about the female and the female body in your work. Can you tell me about your interest in that?
Yeah, so as I began to read more broadly, which my education was, a lot of the writing was just all white men. And I had a summer that I like logged everything I was reading. So that was the summer of 2008. So I was like 19. Everything was white men, except for a biography of Natalie Coughlin. But that was written by a man. So I think part of it is because it's the body I have. But growing up swimming and participating in sports and pursuing that at a high level, as a child and a young adult, I didn't accept that people thought women couldn't perform like men and be strong in their work and in their life. So as I entered the workforce and realized how different the expectations were and just how women are treated, like in the lobby, I was watching the TV and Mindy Kaling gave this powerful graduation speech. And one of the first things that was said about her was that she was adorable. So it's language like that where women are supposed to be demure and nice and good. And all those like silly, sweet words that I don't think women of any color should have to try and fit some sort of box like that. There's just so much more to the female identity and a non-binary identity that you can't say we're all the same. And so as I write, I'm just trying to explore that and sort of articulate what I'm seeing.
Tell me about your background as an athlete.
Well, I grew up swimming, playing soccer and gymnastics. And then I really stuck with swimming and ended up having a scholarship to Rutgers, the State University of New Jersey, and pursued it at a high level. Where another thing where I think I'm so obsessed with identity is because as an athlete, growing up, there weren't as many role models where they're more than just athletes. So I just worked very hard at that and like punished my body with the training we do and pushing through injuries and ending up with some pretty severe shoulder injuries that are going to be with me for the rest of my life just because of that, I'll call it drive and determination to try and reach a high level.
So even then, were you kind of grappling with this, like, you know, I am smart, I'm creative, I'm a writer, I'm not just a swimmer? Did you feel like you were getting pigeonholed at that point when you say that there weren't role models who were more than an athlete?
Yes, and I think that's part of why I also wanted to escape to a city after school, because swimming and athletics had been my life for almost 20 years. Because I started swimming in swim lessons at like 4, and then I swam until I graduated.
I was never an athlete at a high level, but I did the same sport my whole life. And so I'm curious, did you keep swimming because you loved it, or was it just what you did?
Both. Because I saw it as my way to like going to a college that I would be able to just experience more, which is funny that I wanted to experience more, but I was pigeonholing myself in this idea that I'm an athlete and I have to fit that mold. And when you're an athlete, you're on a team and it's always for the team, which is great. You're always working for something greater, but sort of who you are isn't as important. So it's like something that I think really can help you like grow as a person, but also something that can get you stuck in the same cycle of behavior over and over. So I retired. Well, I know it sounds, when I tell people I've retired from swimming, they just look at me and say like, but do you get in the water?
Never to touch the water again.
Never again. I like splash around in the ocean. But in my work, in my writing work, the way I've sort of brought swimming into it is just the fierceness that I think someone's body can have. And I didn't start to really understand that strength that doesn't have to be just for one specific goal of like making it to the NCAAs or making it to Olympic trials. But it can just be to like express yourself and move and feel strong. So like as an adult, I started practicing circus arts in Baltimore because since I'm not professional, it's just for fun and it's just exploring possibility.
Did you get to this kind of acceptance and realization quickly, or what was the transition to go from like elite competitive athlete to this new relationship with your body where you're not depending on it to meet a concrete goal?
Right. It's still a process because I still do things like train for a half marathon and then end up with shin splints where I can't run for 6 weeks because I just wasn't listening to my body telling me to rest. So it was a long process of reading memoirs of people like Natalie Coughlin or Anthony Irvin, who's an incredible sprint freestyler that I believe he's still swimming. He retired at 19 because he was tired of the expectations, but came back to the sport later and swam in the 2016 Olympics. But yeah, I feel like it's just an ongoing process where starting circus arts really helped me see having a body as not just a burden, but something that you can have fun with and explore like what you can do. Like we do conditioning and train pull-ups, but it's not just about being able to say I can do so many pull-ups. It's about being able to perform for 4 minutes to a Kesha song.
And now you will do your circus performance right here in the podcast studio, right?
Yeah, I'm just going to whip out my lira from my pocket.
Yeah, and I just learned what a lira was in the elevator, but Tracy was explaining to me it is the Cirque du Soleil big circle thing you hang off of, right?
Yeah, it's the big hoop where they come in different sizes depending on how tall you are. But you can sit inside it, and so your head's not touching the top of it. And it's made of steel, usually. So you end up with a lot of bruises when you're doing any circus thing. It's pretty tough.
It seems extremely difficult.
But it's very fun.
So obviously you were writing from a young age, your Firefly poem. But do you remember when you knew you wanted to be a poet and a writer, or when it became more professional to you?
It didn't become more professional until partway through the MFA program. I started in 2012, but still was suffering or just feeling sort of an imposter syndrome where I wouldn't like call myself a writer or a poet. I was very quiet about it. But early on in the program, like at orientation, I met Amanda McCormick, who is also a poet, writer, performer, book artist. And so we created Ink Press Productions, so we publish books, but they're small chapbooks that are handmade and letterpress printed in some way. And we're really interested in exploring the way that we can experiment with genre and performance and the literary event. So it's when we started doing that regularly, like we host a very irregular reading series called Unicorn Pizza, because who's going to forget that name?
Yes, great point.
And we work with a lot of local Baltimore artists. So that's when we started working together. That's when I saw writing and creating as something I could do consistently outside of academia and, outside of the school environment.
Well, that's interesting that you had already started an MFA in writing and you mm-hmm. didn't yet consider yourself a writer. Like, what made you want to get this MFA, and what did you think you'd be doing before, if you weren't conceptualizing yourself as a writer?
I feel like it's such a writer thing to be nervous about putting on the identity of a writer. But I was really lucky to meet someone like Amanda, and then our professors, Kendra Kapelke, Steve Matanley, Betsy Boyd, Marion Winnick, and a couple other people I worked with there. I think it's, from other people I've talked to, it's a very different MFA experience, where we were encouraged to find our own writing identity and not write a certain way. Like, Iowa is an incredible school, but you can also sort of hear in a lot of their work, like, those writers work like a way they have been trained to write, which is, their writing style is incredible, but at the University of Baltimore, I didn't feel like I had to be a certain type of writer. So I started to just realize that I wanted to write, to share my own experiences and write a lot about health and the female body, especially after I had a few workshop experiences where I was told I wasn't like the right kind of feminist, or I wasn't old enough to write about the body. And those adverse experiences where what I was writing about was being questioned actually helped me solidify why I felt like I was a writer and had something to say.
So you had the confidence to kind of know what you were doing was right and was your own path, rather than be like, oh, I guess I shouldn't write about those things. Like, I guess I should correct that and not write about the body. Or did you ever go through that experience?
Oh, I definitely did. I mean, still, when I sit down and I'm writing, I ask myself, like, is anyone really going to read this? But then really, like, 90% of creative work is just saying, I'm just going to write it. I'm going to do it. I'm going to put it out there. I have people I trust that I can workshop with and ask for feedback from. And then I can take something to either an open mic or a reading where I've been asked to perform and see how the audience reacts. Because I see poetry as much more communal, and writing really is much more communal, where it's like, it's not just for you. It's about how people are responding. So like, for example, I read at the Little Patuxent Review launch reading last weekend, and I read part of To Tracy Like, To Like, Like. And there were a couple people that came up to me after, and it was such an honor and an emotional experience for them to say, like, they wanted to buy the book because they knew someone that was struggling with chronic illness that they felt like they would want to read this, and it would, like, help them feel less alone.
Well, yeah, tell me about your chapbook. I always botch the name, but it's that repetitive thing we were talking about.
Yeah, so To Tracy, Like, To Like, Like, which my publisher, Michael Zuloff of Akinoga Press, and I had long conversations about the title and if it should be To Like Tracy or To Tracy Like, sort of playing on that syntax of young woman that's criticized, where if you say like, it immediately means you're not qualified.
And kind of in the podcast vein, I don't think enough people listen to Female Trouble to get much feedback like that, but you'll hear, you know, female broadcasters, female radio personalities and podcasters who have been, you know, on NPR for 30 years and they still get that feedback. You know, they still get emails, all from men, of course, about their vocal fry, about saying like too much.
I mean, it's totally true. And there's also like the upward inflection that in readings, I really try and shut it down. But it's just some sort of habit. To Tracy, like is about navigating like feelings of being a female body, having a body in a vulnerable state in terms of like just, you know, bodies are very fragile. Like we like to think they're solid enough, but your health can be gone in an instant. I've spent a long time with a chronic illness that was like finally diagnosed and finally received treatment for, but it puts you in a very vulnerable state. And so then when you compound that with being a young woman trying to make my way professionally, there's talk about if women being more vulnerable and emotional, and this long poem is a lot of my struggle with like not wanting to be vulnerable in that way when I already feel so vulnerable. So it's this like cycle.
Yeah, I am glad you brought up vulnerability because I wanted to ask you about that. That was something that definitely struck me about the poem. And it is a very vulnerable piece of work in its own right. Like you're putting yourself out there in this way. And I think all writing is really vulnerable in that sense. Mm-hmm. But then you talk about in the poem how you don't want to be gentle and you don't want to, like, you want to find your strength and you don't want to be too vulnerable. So tell me about kind of navigating that line of wanting to eschew that vulnerability while, like, being vulnerable about that.
Yeah, it's a lot of the contradiction and ambivalence that I feel and experience, which are pretty much the same word. But the whole, I think, so I started the poem in 2014. So now it's 2018. So even though it's only 6 pages in Word, it took a lot of drafting and revising to sort of, to come to a non-resolution to a poem. Because at some point, it had to end. And Michael and I talked about how much longer it should be or not be. So to try and navigate it in the writing, I bring in a lot of experiences of like things I've been called in workshop or things I notice about like Zoloft commercials or like Ask Men's YouTube page.
Yeah, I had not heard of that YouTube page until I read your poem. I don't think I'll be seeking it out after that.
Don't seek it out. It's
just shudder and move on.
Yeah, it's a shudder and move on because what I watched on that page was just a very like blanket way to treat women. And so part of this poem is saying like there's no one way to treat someone. Or like that's not something I specifically say in this poem, but I was thinking about that a lot as I wrote.
If you started it 4 years ago, I mean, mm-hmm. how have you and your work changed since then? And what was the process of writing a fairly short work over a long period of time like? Not short in terms of poem, you know, it's a long form poem, but like you said, it is not that many words, but you're like coming back to it over and over the course of a long period of time in which I would imagine you and your writing are changing and in flux.
Yeah, so it was really just a very long drafting process where I was working on other poems. So I was working on my thesis because at the University of Baltimore, you look at all your work over the time you've been there and then you create a collection, which is chapbook length. So it's like around 40 poems or less. And then you make the book and you self-publish it. So I initially had thought this was going to be a part of that collection. But this is set as emails to me and to Tracy. So I felt like the form in this was very different from those more prose poems that ended up being in I Want Your Tan, which is the name of that book. And then I was also putting together a full-length collection, which is still has gone through multiple revisions and is still out with small press publishers waiting for acceptance or rejection. So as a writer, while working on this, I was traveling to read in different places. I was publishing smaller collections and getting to meet other writers. And of course, reading a lot, which I allow my influences to be really transparent in my work. Like while I was writing to Tracy Lake, I read Brenda Shaughnessy's Hour Andromeda a few times, which is this collection published in, I think, 2012, that ends with this really incredible long poem called Hour Andromeda, where Shaughnessy is sort of trying to revision a world where her and her young son are safe. And it's an incredible poem, and that might not be doing it justice. But I think to be a good writer, you have to read a lot. So with the big things like vulnerability and health that I'm writing about, I wanted to just let there be a lot of influences and creative growth. Since I'm only 30 now, so it's my writing career is still very young.
Beyond direct influences, was there a writer or a piece or anything that you feel really changed the direction of your work or brought something into focus for you?
So there are a couple authors that really changed how I felt poetry could be experienced and could be written. It was, the first is Dorietha Lasky's Black Life, where there's this, just these bizarre, incredible poems where, like this one poem, I Am a Politician, has the lines, I am a politician, I will be very nice to you, or smile big to you, but then I will turn around and write the creepiest poems about you that have ever been written. So people, like, so she writes in a very direct way that can be a little scary, but I like that her poems are scary. And then Claudia Rankine's Don't Let Me Be Lonely is a collection I read in 2015. And so that book came out, I think, in about 2003, and it's about her experience as an African-American woman in a post-9/11 world, feeling unsafe and also having like health issues that are bringing this safety from the outside and the inside and kind of coming together in her writing. So that book was a huge influence. And then I read Citizen right when it came out. And those, her prose poems are just incredible and direct, and you can't look away because they are so, she is so clear in what she says. So that, you know, as a writer reading her, seeing how she just puts everything on the table was something I really admired and wanted to, going forward in my own work, make sure I was doing in some way.
You talked about the summer that you realized you had read all male authors, and now, you know, these influences you're citing are women. And what was kind of the turning point for you? Was it kind of realizing that summer, like, the limited scope of what you had read, or what inspired you to kind of broaden your reading in that way?
I think leaving, you know, finishing school and then realizing, like, looking back at my reading history, that I'd only read, mostly read men, shocked me when I was grappling with wanting to be a writer and I am not a man. So what does that mean? And so I just, over time, have been seeking out reading women, getting recommendations from friends, reading writers of color, just reading as widely as possible, because there are so many different perspectives that are valid and are written about.
I had the same experience in school, now that I'm thinking back on it, and I feel like it's a real self-education. And interestingly, in your health, which you write a lot about, it's like you have to be your own advocate, and then almost to become a better writer and reader, you have to put in the work and become your own advocate, because people aren't going to put that in front of you.
No, and they'll sometimes tell you that what you're thinking isn't valid. Either explicitly they'll tell you that, or implicitly by telling you that your pain is not a big deal. So for me, my big struggle was with endometriosis, which is, interestingly enough, feels like a big topic now.
Yeah, a lot more people seem to be coming out about their experiences with it and describing a similar experience. They're not believed, or it's not a big deal, or it's just dismissed as women's pain, and it's actually a much bigger deal.
Yeah, and it's, you're not just being a wimp, which is something that, wanting to not feel vulnerable, to use a silly word like a wimp, you want to feel strong. So I heard about Abby Norman's book, Ask Me About My Uterus, which I've been telling everyone to read. So if you're listening to Female Trouble, and all the authors I've mentioned, they should be read. She writes so powerfully in the book about how much she was dismissed over time, since endometriosis has been something talked about in the medical establishment, how it's been dismissed. The first doctor to diagnose it said it was a disease of upper middle class white women because they delay childbirth. And if you would just have childbirth when you started your period, you would not have this problem.
So come on, Tracy, just go have a kid. Why are you complaining?
I'll just have babies. It's no
problem. No problem, yeah.
I know, that's... So reading people like Abby Norman and Dorietha Lasky and Claudia Rankine kind of helped me trust my voice when there are these people in workshops or in person sort of questioning my validity as a writer.
Well, can you read us a passage from your chapbook?
Sure. I can start at a timely spot, sort of in the middle, where I am writing about Facebook and what we feel like we should be sharing.
Sounds good.
Okay. To Tracy, if people are getting their information from Facebook, we should all be paid for generating content. Instead of what's on your mind, how about have you thought this through before posting to the public? Or what are you adding to the cultural conversation? To me, time to start making salad with potatoes. Hey, what's your name? Hey, what's your name? Hey, what's your name? Other strangers are kind enough to say, be careful. I should make another potato reference. There is grief in understanding. To Tracy, existence is not about preference. This boldness is not for you. To me, when someone says life is good, I do not mean to sorrow my brow. My brow is sorrow. Look up fear of human potential. To Tracy, step into the philosophy games of men. When you hug someone, are they dust? When you step on a cockroach, is it math? Argue that a rock isn't solid, but what will you tell me when one is thrown through my window? To me, I can tell you worship authority. At the risk of being brave, believe the matter. At the risk of being honest, bewitch the voice. The audience expects a delay. But really, life and death are wearing me out.
Thank you. Tell me about that passage.
Well, there's a lot going on.
There's a lot going on.
Because I write, as much as I don't like feeling vulnerable, what you share in writing is so vulnerable. And in this age of social media that I grew up at the very start of it with AIM, AOL Instant Messenger.
Oh, of course. Did you have a good first screen name?
It was Electric Blue 72.
Okay, that is so cool. I did not have a screen name because we won't get into my issues with my mother not letting me have that in this podcast. But my first email account was DreamyBlue18 at Hotmail.
What?
We are so close.
We're kindred.
Mine was because of blue eyes. What was yours coming from?
Mine was from like the blueness of water.
Oh, very cool. I'm a Pisces too, so I like the water reference.
I'm not a Pisces, but a Cancer, so another water sign.
Very good. So okay, we can break down our AIM screen names and emails after this, but
yes.
Sorry to interrupt you. Go on.
So we're like in this age of sharing a lot. So my question when I write and when I'm on the internet is how much do I want to share? How vulnerable does that make me feel? Do I still feel safe sharing all of this? And then I am getting into existence and
existence, you know, a small topic we can definitely cover in the scope of this podcast.
In this one poem, you'll come away feeling very troubled about your existence. I really appreciate writing that's very straightforward. So when it becomes very twisty and turny, it feels like a game. So I play around with that game some in these passages, and the game of like who gets to decide what is right and correct as philosophy is steeped in authority. So I have a lot of, I just question what is the ultimate authority in creativity and things you share.
Have you come to your own personal answer about sharing yourself? And just going back to kind of the social media passage, have you found something that feels comfortable to you with like, I do share a lot, I hold this part of myself back? Like, I feel like a lot of people kind of fall into a black or white camp, and like some people really share so much of themselves and they really find connection and community in that and strengthen that vulnerability. Other people are like, that's just, you know, this is just personal to me. I keep it all to myself. I don't share certain parts of myself on social media. And I feel like there has to be a gray area. And I'm curious if you, through your work, have kind of like found what works for you.
I still very much live in the gray of it, where social media has helped me connect with a lot of writers and other women experiencing chronic illness. So like it's, you know, you have to share some for people to know those things about you. But like a passage I didn't read that gets, healthcare just feels very vulnerable, especially when you're sick. And I think back to a news story I heard where this woman was being treated for Lyme disease, but her insurance carrier found that she was writing about having Lyme disease on social media before she was officially diagnosed by her doctor, and her coverage was denied.
That is so dystopian and creepy. Oh, my God.
So it's things like that where I'm still careful in what I say, because I think you have to protect yourself. And so there's always like a struggle to decide like what is appropriate for this time. And like social media at its best is a way to connect with others. So you do want to share so you can connect with people in your life that you might not have known or having a similar struggle.
Because you write about the body and chronic illness and women and the female body, do you think your work is political?
I think the act of writing in any way can be political. And if a lawmaker reads my poem and says, wow, we should really keep that pre-existing condition clause in the ACA, then that's great. So I don't set out to be a political writer, but it seems like it just becomes political because I have things to say about healthcare and about the body and about how people should be respected.
What are you working on now and what's next for you?
I am still editing a full-length collection, tentatively titled Tongue, Dream, Spine. And so that's just, I'll keep working on that until I receive so many rejections that it's time to put it aside for a long time. Because a lot of writers I know, like, you know, you have a full-length collection that goes through like 50 to 100 rejections. And then it gets picked up and it's at the right time and people are really excited to read it. And I am also working on writing essays. So that's a very different genre because you have to have more obviously logical jumps from line to line since it's a much different syntax than poetry. So that is a new and fun challenge for me.
Thanks for coming in, Tracy.
Thanks for talking with me, Quinn.
Thanks for listening to my conversation with Tracy Diamond. You can attend the release party for To Tracy Like, To Like, Like at Greedy Reads in Fells Point on July 12th at 7 p.m. I'm Quinn Kelly, and this is a Baltimore Sun podcast. Female Trouble is available everywhere you listen to podcasts, and we're also on Twitter at FMLTrouble. Our theme song is Dope Girls by Shifty, featuring TT the Artist. Thanks again. Dope Girls!